Pennsylvania is perhaps the oldest center I know, and began about 1940, and was a means of developing a discipline of people called Kirkridgers, who would not only come to retreats at least once a year, but would develop a discipline that would enable them to be a part of a continuing community through the year. And Kirkridge has become one of the strong points of retreat and conference development across the years. John Oliver Nelson was a teacher at Yale Seminary and in the field of Christian vocation, and saw the need for the recovery of vocation, Christian vocation, particularly among the laity, and bought this 300-acre site in Pennsylvania, and Kirkridge has now a place where there's three different campuses, one on top of the ridge at the lodge, the old farmhouse, and another campus that has been developed where quite a flow of people are in and out of that rural community every week, and in many instances every day. Very much like the coming and going at Holden, but their capacity is not nearly as large as this. Well, there's been a good deal of struggle, I think, to recapture some of the spiritual vitality and strength of our heritage into the structure and system and institution of the church in our time. And centers have emerged in many places that have been a part of that recovery and revitalization and restoration of vitality. The bringing back of the basic symbols, the basic substance that makes possible the nurturing of the community in the faith, as well as the equipping of the people for their mission. out of the 17 years, at the end of the 17 years of parish work, I attended a retreat at a place that was being set up to become a continuing center, and that changed the whole nature of my life and ministry. We spent the weekend with a group of a dozen men. The house was on the campus of Earlham College, which may be known to some of you, a Quaker institution in the Midwest, and this facility was being leased from the college. It was a big old manor house. Could sleep 19 people. It had just been furnished. They were looking for a director to begin this institute, and we found it was available and took a group it happened to be a group of men in that case from our parish, and spent a weekend in retreat there. It was during the retreat that I learned, I was beginning to be aware of a new process of life that made possible some new involvement of the congregation. More of the face-to-face, dialogical community of search together. And to come apart, as I remember, I think Bill said yesterday, to inhale in order to go back to your life, to exhale a new quality of life. Well, when it was indicated that they were looking for a director, conversations began that led to my going there 6 months later. And I became the director of that house, which was called Yoke Fellow Institute. Now, they're not just centers, but in some cases, centers are related to movements. And the Yoke Fellow movement had its beginning pretty much with Dr. Elton Trueblood, who is a rather nationally known Quaker philosopher, professor at Stanford and Harvard and other places. He came to Earlham and was a very insightful man to be able to point out the hollowness of the church's life in the late 40s and 50s and the cut flower civilization that we were witnessing in the mid-century, and issued a call to the church to a revitalization, to a new rootedness of faith and a new clarity of mission. And that is really the philosophy of Yoke Fellows, based largely on Jesus' call to commitment, take my yoke upon you and be a learner after me. And the apostle used the term to Philemon and others, my dear yoke fellow. but the 11th of Matthew is the basic yoke fellow philosophy. Well, it simply is a disciplined company of people and has been very much the initiator of small groups in local parishes. When a group of people had come to the center for a retreat, They were given certain skills and tools if they so desired, that when they returned home, what was started in the retreat could continue in a process of something like the Wesleyan class meeting that John Wesley used as a nurturing tool among the early Methodists. So that the group process could continue the vitality, the process of the encounter, the koinonia community, even though there was just 6 or 8 or a dozen persons, in a regular weekly experience back home. And then the center began to provide resources and to nurture those groups. Well, we spent 17 years at that center and saw quite a flow of people in and out. Our capacity was not nearly as large as this. We eventually built a new center with a round room to emphasize the philosophy of involvement of all Christians in common ministry. I got the idea from one of the lay academies in Germany. We had about 3,000 people a year, around 120 groups that were there. Most of the groups were led in some measure by the staff, but we did have many events which were not adequate to serve, and so we brokered specialists, outside resources who would come for those particular needs. After 17 years, it seemed that it was wise that there be a new chapter in terms of a new style of ministry for ourselves. Patsy had been a professional with young children, and I had spent those 17 years rather intensely in the center work. So we were investigating the possibility of developing a center in Washington, D.C., and went into the Lilly Foundation, which is a foundation, philanthropic institution made possible by the Eli Lilly family and the large pharmaceutical firm, a foundation that perhaps spends more to encourage religious causes in the country than all other foundations put together. And I went in to simply discuss the prospect of if a center were to emerge in Washington, if that foundation would find that as a point of interest. And they said, well, we get many requests around that kind of thing. Why don't you come and help us decide them? They were in the process of growing into becoming a large foundation because of new legislation that required certain payout at the end of each year. And instead of a $5 million foundation, they rather suddenly became a $40 to $50 million foundation, and their staff was growing from about 5 to 60. And I was there a year, and there were many interesting things, and I worked with a few centers, but my interest in going was to work with centers like Holden. And I saw that in the defining of their objectives and goals, that was not going to be a large point of interest. And so I designed the program that I'm now doing and presented it to the foundation, and it was funded through a theological seminary in Dayton, Ohio, a model of theological education which I count very valuable for the future, wanted to encourage, and so I do some teaching the winter and spring terms, and nearly all of the fall and some pieces of the rest of the year we spend visiting as a consultant to centers to share our experience, to be resources, and to build some linkage between centers, because I find that even the centers themselves get so busy with what they're about, they don't even know their neighbors or centers, other centers that are doing interesting things too. So what we find among centers, we've been now in the past 2 years, we try to get to about 20 a year. We find great diversity among them, diversity in their total life in terms of setting, for instance. There would be none who would have be able to capture or offer quite the environment that Holden Village offers in terms of setting. But there are still very interesting settings that they have. For instance, a bank barn in northern Ohio that has been turned into a very marvelous retreat center that feeds 50 people down in what used to be the horse stables, and up in the main barn floor is a beautiful fireplace and conference room and offices and book room, and in what used to be the haymow is a beautiful balcony of bedrooms, and then they have other facilities adjacent to it. There is a in near Greensboro, North Carolina, a young couple who is just in the process of constructing a retreat house with their own hands, graduated with a PhD from Drew University a few years ago, but before they went, they bought 40 acres of land in North Carolina and weren't sure what they wanted to do with it, but they had an idea in their head they wanted to dream about. And while they were in university, they made a tour of centers across the country, and it's quite likely they may have stopped at Holden if they knew about it, and began to dream about the creation of a center in this green forest spot that they had their 40 acres in North Carolina. We stopped there in February and saw the work of Bill Stevens' own hands. He had never laid a brick in his life, but until he started the fireplaces in this structure, they had built a beautiful 15-bedroom retreat house with a beautiful conference room, dining room, and that's an amazing creation with the hands and hearts of two persons. They only had physical help on one project, which was to put the long sections of connected guttering on the very long overhangs of the building. In terms of, and then there's Laity Lodge, which is in West Texas, back in West Texas Plain Country. You have to travel a long ways in West Texas to get there, and then you go up a riverbed for a mile, and if it's in flood time, you have to wait till the flood's over. The floods don't last long, but right at the time of a heavy rain, if you get in, you may be delayed a day or so getting out. You have to go up the riverbed a mile and a half to get to Laity Lodge. This was established by a family foundation in Texas. Bill Cody is a tremendous director. They have a flow of quite a few thousand people in and out of there. The bedrooms are in buildings that look with walkways on the outside of the building where you look straight down into the river of blue water, and it's built out of solid rock, sort of against a hill. And they provide for a very interesting feature. They have five camps on that river, all of which are free for anybody's use who arranges, schedules properly, and brings their own resources. Free use of these camps, some of them very modern and some more rustic. And they even have large groups such as patients from mental hospital in Texas to come there for a week at a time with their staff and all the rest, to give them some experience of that kind of outdoor life. So I say there's great diversity in terms of environment that centers have been able to create and offer people who come. Considerable diversity as to staff. I know of no place that could boast of as many volunteers as Holden is able to command and appeal to, but there are many places that have a good many volunteer persons who enable the process of the center to function across the year. So that there are some centers that have only one program staff person. There are not many that have a dozen paid staff such as Holden Village has, and supported by all the volunteers that I mentioned. The programs which they offer have great diversity. Very often, nearly every center would have a segment of programming across the year which they would put under the title of personal growth and development. And in that there would be all sorts of retreats, all sorts of self-understanding experiences, and the kind of things that Dale was doing the morning of the day that we arrived here, the life-giving lab that he was conducting on the two mornings or afternoons, whatever it was that he was here. I was talking to him about that. So there would be, that would be one kind of programming. The retreat experience when centers begin is kind of the awakener, the thing that turns people on to new possibilities. They begin to be aware of the human potential movement that begins to offer other kinds of personal growth opportunities that the center offers as a resource. And when they come for a retreat, that is the door opener that begins a new life for many people, and they discover that center as a resource base and a training center for them. So that the retreat is a very essential aspect of program components. But it's quite unfair, I think many centers feel, to simply awaken people, whether it's clergy or laity, with new spirit, new vision, new sense of discipleship, to go back home, to be, in a sense, lost in what, if that parish is not itself alive, for them soon to be like a leaky basket. You know, have you ever tried to carry sand in a leaky basket? You don't go very far until it has somehow dwindled out. And to send a person away without, with new hope, without being able to sustain that, in a community of faith that will nurture that hope and that new sense of discipleship. So that centers, another segment of programming is that they offer many resources and skills for the revitalization of a parish, so that a person who comes to retreat might more likely go back to a congregation that is alive and alert and has a sense of future hope and of vitality and of spirit and community of growth and so on. A third segment, and I sense such as the lay theological week here, and I was talking to Bill, a board member, and Wes Preeb and some others about the prospect of thinking of a lay abbey. And I guess it's a little of what I've been seeing and hearing a good deal about in terms of a lay academy, a mini-seminary, as it were, in every congregation, to provide a vital school of faith and life, of belief and service, you know, of devotion and Christian action in the arenas of the world, so that we offer more in the congregation than what many people experience. I speak from our own situation in Dayton, Ohio, a parish of 3,000 souls, and as I observe it, unfortunately our travels keep us from being as involved as we've been accustomed to being in local parishes, but as I observe it, it's largely a Sunday morning experience of an hour that's spent within a very fixed structure of time and style of participation. And so where do people go for the nurture of faith to learn the great resourcefulness of prayer and the enrichment of their own life and self-understanding and the whole development of their own potentiality, if the church doesn't offer that to them in their own school of faith and life? And where does the layperson, who links in with the arenas that are developing so much stress in human existence today, business, industry, medicine, health, government, politics, whatever you want to mention, how will that person translate in those arenas this new life of the kingdom that is being nurtured within that person? Except they have a base of support and a resourcefulness that will feed that ethical, moral motivation and conviction that will enable them to stand in those arenas as servants of Christ and live out in their decisions and actions what the kingdom is calling for from them and what the kingdom of our Lord is trying to do in those kingdoms of this world. So centers are becoming bases where curriculums are beginning to develop, where lay people can be trained at centers like this to be teachers in the academy in their own local congregation. And wow, what that could mean to a congregation across a 10-year period. What do you think the curriculum for that should be? I haven't really seen the best model yet. A lot of people are talking about it. Out of your experience, you might even be willing to write down what you think would be one or two or three very essential things for you if your needs were met in such an academy in a local church. What would it have to deal with? What would it have to offer? I'd be grateful for any feedback, either in our discussion in a few minutes or if you would write it down. And just one other quick word. The diversity of settings and of staff and of programming and of follow-through. Many centers have a great variety of ways in which they follow through with events that come. They have here I discover they sold 5,000 cassettes last year of resources that go out beyond this place, carrying to many places the lectures and insights and benefits of this. That's one form of follow-up. But there are also kinds of forms of follow-up where the staff actually has clusters or regions to which they go out occasionally and have events out there which are renewing and gathering together the alumni of a place like Holden to have refresher events during the year. And they have resources that are sent out in mailings that keep sort of a linkage with the community, and they begin to hear each other and feel connected with each other. As I said, we've been to over 40 centers in the first 2 years, mostly east of Illinois. There's been a few in Texas. And this is because those were the ones we knew immediately and had linkage with when we were a director of a center. And so there's nobody that knows how many centers that does exist, so far as I know. And one thing I'm hoping to be able to establish is a fairly firm directory of centers that would help a person who might be interested to know where the centers are that would be available to such a person or to a parish. I don't know whether you know how many centers are in your area here. We'll be in a center in Whidbey Island, north of Seattle. We'll be with two centers in the Portland area. And I'm sure that I don't yet know. We'll be having a regional meeting of center people near Portland next Wednesday and Thursday. And I suspect there will be center people there that I've not heard about. And that's one way we make the discovery. We try to have a regional meeting in every section that we go to discover centers and to learn about their health and what we can learn from them. One thing that we're trying to do is to build some linkage. So we have a newsletter. I have a few copies if anybody's particularly interested in that. That's a very minimal kind of thing. We have regional meetings, and there are two associations that make possible center people's connections. One is a conference center association, which is pretty much an association of centers that are just hospices. That is, they have a director who facilitate the meetings, have everything set up, arrange for the meals, see that the place is proper for people who bring their own program. But the kind of center that we work with is a center that has not always a facility, but nearly always a facility, a staff that creates program, designs program, and offers it to its region, and has a regional ministry. A good many of them are denominationally oriented, as Holden Village is, but are also ecumenical, as Holden Village is, as I understand it. A good many of them do not have adjudicatory direct connections and are entirely ecumenical, with their own board, their own budget, and their own life and responsibilities. I'd say until now, the groups that we've been with, it's been about 50-50 of one kind and 50 of the other. The things that we try to do is, both out of our experience and our learnings, is to offer to the staff and to the board or committee, whatever the administrative body is, explorations in the areas of management, what it means to be a trustee, what's the criteria for being a trustee of a center such as this? What does it mean to be a manager of an institution such as this? What kind of communications exist within the management team and staff? What's the internal structure and quality of life? And we do try to do a lot of listening, and in some instances we're able to build some bridges where there's tensions and conflict and have felt that we've left with a greater sense of community after those experiences. Other perhaps more important areas is in the area of programming, because it's possible for a center to be fixed in its routine, just like a local church. And so our aim is to raise the principle of continual renewal with renewal centers, assuming that they need to be continually renewed just as any other system or any other organization, and that's what we're about. In the area of funding, I spent a year with the Lilly Foundation, as I mentioned. We do conduct some workshops and training, and we have a session and a program of training for trustees and a program of training for staff persons of centers. I think that can be enough just to stop there. You have something of the flavor of what we're about. I'd say that there are 360 Roman Catholic centers that has its own linkage and association called Retreats International. I'm a member of the Committee of Research and Development of that group because we're building some bridges between the Protestant and Catholic centers, which is a very new thing. Many Catholic centers are as open and ecumenical and as free and as happy with holy hilarity as Holden Village, and it's exciting to be a part of their life. Their program, their staff, their openness is really amazing. A whole new thing is happening. In fact, their board of Retreats International are in the process of moving to Notre Dame's campus, where the whole continuing education program of the university is going to be devoted to providing resources for the retreat centers across the nation. So there's really three links. The Catholic centers, of which there's about 360, some diocesan, some of the various orders. I'd say that my estimate, from what I now know, there must be at least 150 significant Protestant centers. 500,000 people make their way a year to the Roman Catholic centers. My estimate would be that at least 250,000 people make their way in and out of the life and spirit and dynamic of Protestant centers. And that begins to say a great deal to me in terms of a phenomenon that's on the horizon for the future. In terms of religious trends, in terms of the shaping of tomorrow, in terms of what the life of Christ's people might be. I can't define it. As Walter Capp said, it's difficult, and others have said here, I've heard, it's difficult to see quite the shape it's going to be taking. But centers like this are going to have a very strong piece in that shaping. And I celebrate that, rejoice in it, and thank God for it, and want to invest our lives to do anything we can to strengthen that component of the religious scene in the next decade. You have any thing you want to add? I've stolen all the time.
No. I'm just trying to think.
We weren't really expecting until breakfast to...
So I have not had a separate part of this, being a part of it, but...
Let me say she has, because she is able to be with staff people in our events where she has... The conflict has poured out to her, and she's been a healer in situations that, you know, isn't in the program or isn't structured.
Well, I think I can sense when I know the frustration from which, say, perhaps your director might come, and wife and family, and he has his direct goals. He knows what he's going to, but a wife sort of comes along, is being dragged along. Not really, but
or may have her own profession.
Or may have, yes, have her own profession too, and so there's conflict there. I have sensed, at least where we have been, a great deal of loneliness, particularly with the wives of directors. I'm sorry not to know Mrs. Henderly, and I'm sure she is pouring much into this. But in many ways, they are sort of isolated from an average community. In our own case, simply for nitty-gritty reasons, we had three sons and who are facing college almost like right away, and when one is working with a center, particularly getting one off the ground, income is nominal, and that's not really why we were there. We had a purpose, but also we knew that families did have to go to school, so I was teaching in the local community where our center where we worked, so I was a part of it mostly on weekends. And that can provide also some tension, which I think husbands and wives and directors and so forth have to keep very clear, because I was working in one area while Sam was working, you know, bringing in exciting programs and meeting people, and all at once I was feeling I'm just doing the thing that needs to be done. So there have to be lots of communication and not lots of understanding and nurturing of each other for that. now that we are working with centers, I can see more possibilities than I did when I was within it, and my vision was a little narrow. I think one of the interesting thing was when our boys who were junior high, when we went to Yokefella Institute to establish it, they came home from high school, and they say, "What is it our daddy does?" And that was right. Well, he directs a retreat center. And who ever heard of a high school boy needing or thinking they needed a retreat? Well, what is a retreat center? So we went round and round, is what it was their father did. But one of the terrific things has been the amazing support of our own family. Of course, there was a time of questioning, and rightly so. But when within recent years this particular center was having some financial difficulty during some shifting of times and so forth, these three sons who had watched that grow from a mere bit of lumber and so forth were the ones who came to the defense of the Institute and said, "Well, you know, that they can't close those doors. This is where we grew up, and we stayed out in the cold in the little shed and watched so that the pipes didn't burst, and we've been part of that." Hmm. So I feel that there's a very rich heritage where we've been concerned.
What Patsy's really alluding to, that behind every center, and I've been reading the vision and the dream that brought Holden into beginning, that certainly, you know, has been in the hearts of people like Carol Henderly and Wes Priebe and a multitude of others. And sacrifice is not very painful when that vision has really laid hold of you. So we knew the sacrifice, but we had a vision that really held us through all that. And the family, fortunately, if they hadn't joined in it and been caught by it with me, I couldn't have survived. Well, this is kind of what story we would share. Is there anything of interest? Has it raised any question or?
Question. Our church has a large number of Bible camps, you know, for the youth. And many of these are being used as retreat resources for congregations and people. And I wonder how that fits in with the wider picture that you're talking about, where the place might be designed basically for a retreat center like this.
Yes, every denomination, I find, has campsites where they are winterizing facilities and making other new things possible, pieces of a program such as goes on here, where a group can go from a congregation and spend a weekend or a week, whatever, and have their own program. And that is a kind of resource, there's no question about that. To get people apart from the routine and the commonality of life, to think clearly and uninterruptedly and together and move from one step to another in an event, certainly has its assets. And whatever way you can do it, there are a lot of people that don't have a place like this within reach of them. So they use motels, they use state parks, much less of the dynamic that you offer, but they use what they have. And, you know, the old principle of using what you've got to do the best you can makes possible those things. I'd say that there are levels of resourcefulness. And that, I see, as I, in my estimate, the greater resource is that staff that is trained and able to take people where they are and assess it quickly where they are and lead them on. And that takes a particular kind of skill, and that comes from people, I think, working in that dynamic and in that process. So that the center that has a trained staff seems to me has a level of benefit to afford people in a congregation that's unmatched by any other method. But that's not discounting the other possibilities. Yes, there's a few. There's just a few of each kind, of each issue.
Focused pretty much exclusively on church-related retreat type centers, or have you done any kind of working with similar centers which may have no church record whatsoever, might seem to be like the human potential and so forth? And is there some kind of give and take between them? Or do you find some commonality, I guess, between church-related and more secular kinds of retreat centers?
Well, the dynamics, you know, of human persons in some measure, is the same wherever they are together. Then the aim begins to be defined, and the difference of aim makes for another kind of dynamic. I find myself troubled when I've been with a center that has been almost completely absorbed into the humanistic psychology of their programming. I think without the symbols and substance of the theological orientation and of the faith heritage, there's a tremendous difference and a great lack. Now, mind you, I feel myself a participant in the human potential movement, and I've had some training and skills, and we had a good deal of this in our center. But that was a means and not an end. And I think the difference that I see is when centers make that the end instead of a means, and I see a sadness about that. I think there's nothing quite like the gospel and the dynamic of the Spirit to change lives, to nurture them, and to sustain them, and to give motivation and purpose. Doesn't mean that there isn't motivation and purpose in the human potential movement. I've been greatly blessed and benefited by it. But I'm just making my distinction, at least, between those two types of centers. And I think my estimate is that it's really unfair to a human person to awaken the hopes that the human potential awakens without giving them the full range of possibility, which for me moves, whether first or last, at some point into the greatness and grandeur of Jesus Christ and his creation and his sustaining life and his Spirit at work in one's life. Human potential movement talks a lot about healing. I believe in that. I've seen a lot of it in human persons. But I know that the full range of healing for me is never complete apart from that dimension of faith and life. So I have some biases, obviously, out of my own experience around that. While I have appreciation for the centers that are largely oriented in the human potential, very willing to give anything I can to help them. But when you're asking me the difference in... Do you have an estimate around that?
No, I'm just curious as to whether or not, I guess, a fairly significant number of retreat type of things which have no church or religious orientation.
Oh, yeah.
At all,
you take transactional analysis, you know, that's just a few years old, and there are TA institutes that have sprung up all over the country. And in some instances, they not only have their groups and marathons and workshops, but they actually have centers, and they have institutes. Indianapolis has one. Two clergymen have developed this. Now, it does have, you know, some of the faith factor, but I'm speaking of the whole International Transactional Analysis Association. This is a human potential factor. And human growth centers have multiplied over the country in great numbers. They could talk to each other in very meaningful ways. I think at the level I mentioned, it is where I see the distinctions. Bill?
Sam, I've heard this critique a little bit, but I just want to get your reaction to it, that the response, the great response of members of congregations to such things as renewal retreat centers appears to be an indictment of the spirit and the life of the institutional church itself. That's one part of the question. I want to get a reading from you on that, a response to that. And the other is that if that is the case, carrying through here, that the church really has not been offering what it ought to be offering, terms of renewal of life in Christ, that as we look down the pike then, that there is a sort of a transitional period to which the church itself needs to be subjected or willingly submits, so that a church itself, a congregation itself, becomes a renewal center. Now, there are a good many isolated cases where this is true in the individual congregation, but I would say, and perhaps you'll agree with me, that the overwhelming number of congregations who are involved in this kind of renewal is not so good. It's not that many. But down the pipe there may be, so that renewal centers may fill a definite need now, but to provide the transition for a congregation to reach that point in its life, to be a renewal center. You follow what I'm trying to say?
I think that'd be one of the emphasis of your teaching at a seminary.
In regard to your first question, I certainly discovered in 1957 when I began a center that it was new to me and it was new to everybody else, and it was a threat, there's no question. Except for colleagues and people that knew me, that began the process, and within the first year we only had 700 people in the life of the center. So from 700 to 3,000, you could see it was something that had to build. I'd say we were in operation for 7 years before we had a feeling that people were asking for what we were giving or what we could offer. That is, we had to prove ourselves, we had to show people that we really cared about the church, that we hadn't left the ministry. You know, that's what they said when I left my conference to take up the center work. They said, "Why are you leaving the ministry?" And it was very difficult. The image had to be reshaped, and it's still a long way to go at that. In fact, there was one period where we had a pastor of our own congregation who, whether he fought us or not, he said, "You know, you run that thing down there and I'll run this." And it really is a frightful thing to send people to something that you can't control, that nobody controls. If it really is a work of the Spirit, you know, who can predict what will come out? It's not like putting a bag of stones together and shaking them up and throwing them out, you get the same thing, but you put a dozen people together in a new encounter of the Spirit, and who knows, you know, what they're going to come home with. I remember one group drove back to Lexington, Kentucky, in a large central Christian church there, Disciples of Christ congregation, and they went straight to the pastor's home and sat on his step and said, "Pastor, where have we been and what do we do from now on, because we're not going to be the same." Now, pastors, I think, don't always like to have that kind of thing bothering them. I can understand this. I was a pastor for 17 years. But without question, I think history and experience verifies that the church, like any other system, in this whole industrialized and technological period has gotten into its ruts too. So that somebody has said, if you take the three little letters routine and uniformity and tradition, the first letter of each of those three words spells rut. And that's what has happened, what was felt was happening to many congregations. And when you challenge that and address that, there are people who are going to disagree with you. Now, fortunately for me, I had a bishop who sensed the pathos of the church and its spiritual emptiness and was calling people to look at this problem. In fact, the reason I took a group of lay people to a retreat was because he had arranged a retreat in the same house, 100 miles from me. And he invited a lay person from each of his 17 districts. And fortunately for me, one of the lay persons was from my parish. The lay person from our district was from my parish. He was a man that was not particularly a religious man. He had a staff of 25 doctors in a medical clinic and hospital. And he called me in one day and he said, "Hey, look what I've got. a letter from the bishop to spend a weekend talking about religion. How do you talk about religion for a weekend? He nearly didn't go. He thought he was going to put on a finance campaign to raise money. And I said, you know, I know that man, his concern, his spirit. I value that. I'd like to urge you to go. And Truman Kaler decided to go. He didn't bring anything the bishop suggested. He left his Bible home, and when the bishop called on him to read something, he had to borrow somebody else's. And when he was called on to say grace at a table before a meal, he had to go upstairs and figure one out. He told me this. He called me in when he got back home and said, you know, his words had, his language was already improving. He said that was the darndest experience of my adult life. And it was within 3 months that he called me in again and said, you know what? He said, our parish would benefit greatly if you'd take a group of men to share a kind of experience that I shared, and they won't want to go any more than I did, so I'll pay the way and you take them. Now, that was our beginning. And I look back on that turning point in my life. Well, Truman himself became, you know, if I had been reluctant to that, what I would have missed. That man himself became the chairman of the lay group that was responsible for all the mission outreach of that congregation. And they became the second in the state in terms of their advanced special giving over and above their world service or their missionary giving. They had a missionary doctor in Mozambique. They had a missionary doctor. We just visited him. He's now home at an Indian reservation, and we saw him. He was on our route out here. He's back from Rhodesia. They trained nurses in Korea and people all over the world because of the motivation that was stirred up by one person who was caught on fire. So after 8 or 10 years, the people began saying, what we heard from down there in Union City and Bluffton, we'd like to get in touch with here. How do we do it? And so they began to come and ask. I don't know what the centers will be doing in terms of how it will help to shape the future life of the congregation. My estimate is that if I had another 40 years to give, I'd want to be somewhere in a center, have something to do with centers, because I'm convinced they have a large piece of that shaping that God's calling them to do. And I think they need each other. I think they can do so much more than they're doing if they can really get together and become aware of the full perspective of what's happening.
When you say they,
center people.
All the centers.
Yeah.
And not the center and the congregation.
Well, both, of course. Supposing one of my goals when I left was to see the possibility of how a center, you know, we had out there so many congregations that we knew were turned on and alive. Supposing we could contract with a dozen congregations a year to begin with a serious assessment of, you know, their life and need, and what the missional tasks of their community around them would be. And then with that congregation, in consort with that people, design, you know, a 5 or 10 year program for the development of that congregation and its thrust into that arena. Its life together and its life in that arena. And the staff to work with the congregation, to do what they need to do at the church, and to do what they need to do at the center. And to spend 5 or 10 years in a concerted effort with the shaping of a congregation, you know, at their request and at their will. I think that's on the horizon as a new chapter. And in that case, it would have a potent influence in the reshaping of tomorrow, or the shaping of tomorrow. And I'm certain that if you get a church out there anywhere that's really turned on, that's going to have its potent influence, so that the people around it, just like when that first group of men went back from the retreat I mentioned, my first retreat experience, they met in 2 weeks and said, we know what we've got to do. We barely started, and we've got to meet, you know, Monday mornings at 7 o'clock. And that blew my mind, because if I had tried to organize them to do that before the retreat, I'd have been laughed out of town. Not only that, but the people they worked with in the hospital, in the photography shop, in the funeral home, in the county agricultural agent, and the businesses that they represented, people in the Lutheran, in the Presbyterian, in the Baptist church were saying to their Christian brothers, what is involved in your life that we can't participate in? And pretty soon there were groups in those congregations and people from those congregations that were going to retreats. Now, I'm just saying that if you get a congregation that's alive, you know, the spillover, the outreach, the infection, a good kind of infection is going to go on. So the shaping would be a profounder influence than just that one church. And I could see it begins to be like a cellular force, you know. When you skin graft over a body that's been burned, they just put islands of skin, you know? And that live skin grows and grows until it reaches and covers the whole sore with new life and health. And that's the process I hope will somehow come about.
How do you feel about the suggestion you were saying that, you know, this direction is kind of an indictment of the church? That's a sort of negative thing, or how do you tie that in?
Not an indictment of Christ's body, so much as it is the form, the institution, and the institution itself is admitting it. You go, when I attend the conference in my own church, the struggle with the system, the struggle with the institution is so absorbing, and they find it, you know, sort of almost killing them. And they're saying there's got to be something else, that this is not all there is to the church. It isn't an indictment, it's people saying, what have we missed? Where have we gone wrong? What do we need? It's no longer an indictment of anybody, it's an assessment that I think God's Spirit is bringing to the surface, and everybody is in some form saying, there's much more to what we see in our biblical heritage and history than what we now have in our hands, and we've got to find a way for it. And, you know, from Vatican II to Methodist and Lutheran conferences, if you listen, there's the cry of anguish. And they hear God saying, look what my people have become, and that's not what I intended. And they're trying to find the way back to that intention of God. And there will be people who will hear it as indictment until they listen a little while. Like the usher in a Presbyterian church in Green Bay, Wisconsin, who, when the university students came over, their long hair and their protests and all the rest, he said, we'd meet them at the door and throw them out. They didn't get into our place. But one Sunday morning, I grabbed one guy and threw him out. And when he landed outside, I went out and talked to him, and it changed my life. Now, there will be people who will have radical attitudes and will tend to throw it out, until they begin to listen to the world and to God.
Yeah, well, the church is always in need of continuing reformation, but, you know, everything else changes so much that we sort of hold on to the tradition of the church as a sort of a linus blanket. And that has a real emotional and psychological block to change within the church. Anyway, I think the church itself needs to develop a sort of a doctrine of change, a theology of change, where change no longer becomes a threat to the church. I'm talking about the individual congregation.
Every church, though, has its greenness. You know, John Gardner said, there is no situation so green and fresh and lush but what you can sign signs of decay. And there's no situation so dead and or dying or dismal, but what if you look, there are signs of greenness. We walked with a Warden Forrester down in North Carolina, and I was amazed at his ability walking through some of the dead stuff of the forest, and he'd say, "There's one," and he saw under the shadow of a leaf a little tiny white pine, the beginning, you know, it just had about 4 or 5 or 6 needles, just the beginning. And I realized what John Gardner says is true in the church. There's no situation so dead, but what there's hope and life and a place where the Spirit can get in with new seeds. As they begin to grow, they break even the largest stone. Thank you for listening and for whatever degree of interest you might have of carrying on, and for all that you do to make Holden Village this center of hope for so many, even those who do not come here, but they know that it exists. I hope it has your support of prayer and money and volunteer labor and the rest. Undoubtedly it has. And board members who carry the load of responsibility.